Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power,
fueling the mischief in the beautiful game.
Gamble responsibly. See dunlewy.net.
Okay, so you're very welcome along to the football show. Happy to say Dion Fanning joins us. Dion, evening, afternoon, good to have you with us.
Hey Joe, how's it going?
Very well, very well. We were just very briefly there discussing our hopes for a vaccine and saying we don't want to hear about the minx right now.
The minx, I am not an epidemiologist or an immunologist, although I've done my training on Twitter since March. But we don't need to talk about the minx right now and what their entry into the story can do for the virus. What we want to talk about is the vaccine. I think many people might have heard the interview with Jonathan, Professor Bell on Radio 4 yesterday, when he talked about the possibility of getting back to normal next year, next spring, and he kind of said yes, yes, yes. Now, anyone who listened to that interview would know that he didn't just talk about it in terms of this vaccine, but the significance of this vaccine being that it demonstrates how a vaccine works against coronavirus, and that what that means for other vaccines, what that will do then towards getting things back to normal slowly. But over a period of time, I think it's an amazing development, and we hope that it's not spoiled by minx. Like, if it wasn't enough reason to hate people who wear mink before, like, this is it. Like,
this is it.
Yeah.
So with that kind of hopeful note sounded, we might just get your thoughts on a few different things. Premier League is wrapped up. It has drawn breath from the relentless schedule for a moment. Now, the players continue with the relentless schedule, obviously. Leicester and Spurs, top of the table. What are we to make of the Premier League season thus far? What's jumping out at you?
Well, I think, like everybody, it is, like a lot of people, the strangeness of it in terms of the relentlessness of it, the atmosphere obviously in which it's been played, and the effect, if any, that is going to have, whether players adapt to that over time and find it something that they just forget about, and sometimes you see glimpses of that too, but it is also a very strange situation for players to be playing in. And this doesn't apply just to the Premier League, it applies to all sports. And there is no alternative right now. And I think most people on balance are quite happy to have sport taking place at all. So it is it is what it is, but, I think it adds to the sense between the fixtures and the lack of atmosphere. It's very hard to see it as anything other than a slog from the point of view of the players. And I was struck by, in another sport, I was struck by the England fast bowler Jofra Archer's comments last week when he's talked about he'd been in a secure bubble for, I think, 83 days. And now he's gone to the IPL and another kind of bubble, and he said, you're just counting the days.
Now
that's not how elite sports people imagined life as an elite sports person, and counting the days till it's over. Now clearly the Premier League, because it's going on for so long, it's slightly different, and they're not as in a secure a situation, but it's still pretty limited and rigorous. So I think that sense of it being a bit of a slog could potentially have an impact on how the actual the league itself evolves, and who is, the fact that Spurs are at the top, I think has had some significance, because I read Jonathan Liu had a piece on Jose Mourinho and how this is a pandemic. Maybe a pandemic has made Jose relevant again. And it's, and you know, he's, And there are certain elements of that wearying football. If you're always weary, if, as Jonathan makes his point, if you're always playing with fear, a football that is just is a slog is suited to you. Maybe in a way it's not suited to Manchester City or to Liverpool.
Yeah, and it was quite striking the way their game descended into that slog. You know, we used to talk about bad weather conditions being great levelers. Now it turns out pandemics are too, which is the grim discovery. The thing, with Jose in particular, I was just so full sure this would be a disaster. You know, that he would be angry Daniel Levy isn't signing anyone. Levy would go tired of the whole thing. Jose would try to divide and conquer. And this thing would fall apart in pretty quick fashion. And not so long ago, I thought we were on schedule for that. But Gareth Bale has arrived. There is a general weariness hanging over the league. He's doing okay, actually.
No, he is. And the partnership between Kane and Son up front as well is such a key factor in that. And no, I agree, Joe. I thought, watching All or Nothing, I was struck by the strangeness of this show in terms of bringing Mourinho in, because it was only seen to be going in one direction. Now, maybe there were two great advantages of having Mourinho in. One was the actual content of All or Nothing, because as we saw at the very beginning of All or Nothing, there was a scene when Levy has a conversation with Pochettino, and to say it lacked chemistry would be, you know, to put it very mildly, it was one of the most stilted exchanges. I think, you know, Levy made some comment about Poch's cashmere jumper, and Poch kind of, you know, mumbled something, and I was like, you're not getting a full Amazon series out of this. Like, this is not going to put Spurs on the global media landscape if this is what we're going to have to watch for 8 episodes. But in came Jose, and that transformed. And then the other element where Jose maybe Levy couldn't have anticipated this, but the pandemic comes along, and it does change the dynamic, and they do seem like there is something in what they're doing. I think a team that can defend, that can shut teams out, is actually going to have a few advantages this season.
There is one other broad point I wanted to put to you and get your take on. For a neutral point of view, the fact that Liverpool and Man City are that bit more vulnerable is only a good thing for the league. Like, it's bad when they're playing each other and they're wrecked and they're not as good. You know, we lose that one game. But maybe the upside is there's a bit more jeopardy around their games, because for too much of the last couple of years, Man City-Liverpool games, too many of them were just non-events. I mean, what's made Manchester United maybe more compelling in the last couple of years is that when they go to Goodison with Solskjaer's job on the line, there's a distinct possibility they will lose. That possibility wasn't really there with too many Man City and Liverpool games over the last couple of years. Now, they're regrouping, Liverpool in particular, it seems. You know, I don't think we're going to see Aston Villa score 7 against them again anytime soon. But to not have them so completely clear of about 15 other teams in the league, for me anyway, is a good thing. I didn't enjoy the extent of their stranglehold.
Did you not?
No.
I thought the season before last, when City pipped Liverpool to the title, I thought that was a compelling season. When
great finale, yeah.
But winning finale. Every game, there were, like, rather than there being a kind of subplots with, you know, by, you know, through different, you know, upsets in results, the subplots sort of seemed to take place in games, which at the end of them, inevitably Liverpool or Manchester City won. But the fact that both of them were winning all the time became its own drama, and that they would have to keep doing this, and each week they would have to keep doing it. So they were so good. And like, I always reluctant to kind of go with the idea that watching teams or anyone in sport be, you know, being really, really good is somehow boring. it's like, you know, people said Tiger Woods, you know, Tiger Woods was boring. And it's like, and you look back and you go, no, he wasn't boring. He was just, it was just incredible. What you were watching was incredible. And what you would give to see that again in any sport with anybody, with Federer, with anybody, it's everything. So I think when you're seeing them like that, it was compelling, but without the little bit of you know, slapstick, the element of, you know, anything could go wrong today, which changes it. But equally, at the end of the Premier League, I think you want to see the teams that you believe are excellent winning. Like Leicester winning the league, was that maybe it was a fairy tale, but it was also an example of a league that was really badly contested and blown by a couple of big clubs like Arsenal and Tottenham.
Yeah.
And I don't know if we want that in the end.
No, I don't want to quite go back to that. Interesting stories around Mason Greenwood at the moment.
Yeah. They're like Manchester United, you know, are clearly, you know, they're saying that he wasn't part of the squad at the weekend because he was ill. But there are these repeated stories about his application in training. I think the problem, until Manchester United, and Mason Greenwood is a young player and, you know, hugely, hugely talented player. And, you know, there are these stories about this have been, you know, these have been around for a while. But without sounding like every problem comes back to the same, and there are other bigger problems at Manchester United, whilst they have Ole Gunnar Solskjaer as manager, I think, you know, you're jeopardizing an awful lot, including the development of players like Mason Greenwood, because I don't think he is not the manager for Manchester United. And one day soon, United have to sort of grasp this nettle and realize that they need to get a manager who is kind of fitting for the club, and then you see these issues maybe addressed. Now, it's not that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer can't deal with Mason Greenwood, but the problem is that he is not. There are other problems that arise for Solskjaer, which ultimately undermine his authority as a Manchester United manager. And while when that authority is being undermined, it makes it more difficult for him then to be the person who can actually get somebody like Greenwood playing to his potential. And I think that is an issue. And I think it is the big, you know, it's not the big issue for United, because clearly there's the Glazers, there's how the club is structured, what Edward, you know, their recruitment, Ed Woodward, all that stuff. But a lot of that stuff can be transformed or really, really changed quite quickly if you have Pochettino there, for example, as manager rather than Solskjaer.
And do you think Solskjaer can potentially grow into the role? Like, he's made the tough decision to bench Pogba at the moment. Shows a certain set of stones, doesn't it?
No, he's 100 games in. Like, I think he could have probably done it 98 games before that. I think there is a sort of a hope. Manchester United, the way Manchester United are mirroring the kind of the Liverpool era, like post 95, 93, 94, the way they are kind of making the same mistakes as Liverpool did then, is kind of remarkable. Like, and they're following the same pattern. And Solskjaer, I would look at as maybe like the sort of the Roy Evans era at Liverpool, where, you know, he was like very nice man, steeped in the club, knows everything about the club. Nobody who wasn't a cynic or a pure hater of the club would want anything except to see this man succeed because of all it would mean for him. And he really gets it. And he gets the club, and he knows you don't park in Alex Ferguson's parking space, and you bring the players up to see the cliff to hope that the magic dust lands on their shoulders and they understand what it means. But it's just hope. It's just hope. It's not based on evidence. It's not based on reality. It's not based on anything except some sort of desire that what is real would actually be something else. It's like Donald Trump saying that there's voter fraud. That's just what he, it's just what you want there to be, what you want it to be, rather than actually believing it so. And maybe he can grow over, if there is no pressure and no time limit on how long Ole Gunnar Solskjaer can have, maybe he can improve incrementally as a manager. But that's not what Manchester United need. And I think it does come down to just a kind of a lack of ruthlessness, really. Like, there is a lack of ruthlessness in Manchester United to actually deal with this situation, and hoping that, and I think, and also the fact that Solskjaer is a manager who isn't going to challenge the dysfunction elsewhere in the club.
Hmm.
And that needs to be challenged too. So I think it's a comforting fantasy to think that he will improve, but it's just a fantasy.
The worry is Mourinho did try to challenge the structure at the club. I mean, for his own selfish reasons, not for the greater good of Manchester United, but he did try to challenge it and didn't like the way things were being done. And that just led to acrimony everywhere and fire everywhere. Like, I'm not sure the day where you can somehow wrestle control of the club back from multi-billion-dollar owners is possible anymore.
No, but you don't need to. You don't need, like, Mourinho. But again, that was a failure. That was an appointment failure too. And again, if we come back to, you know, Mourinho's appointment at Spurs, why it might have looked like a bad decision there was because of how he does operate. But the one difference between Mourinho at Spurs and Mourinho at Manchester United is at Spurs, he is joining a club that is kind of, that his personality can loom large over. And people might be more willing to listen to, you know, to take on board the Mourinho effect. Whereas at Manchester United, once he encounters resistance, Mourinho makes things toxic. And that's how he responds to these things, how he responds to resistance is to kind of sort of toxify the atmosphere. So it was clearly never going to work. But it doesn't mean that a strong personality or somebody who knows exactly what they want can't change the entire atmosphere of the club. Klopp is the greatest example of this. Klopp is, like, you look at everything that wasn't functioning before Klopp arrived at Liverpool, including the transfer committee, all these things that people said, you know, were issues, and, you know, there was, you know, Moneyball and all these, you know, all these kind of cynical, you know, old school football articles complaining about guys with laptops selecting players, and all of it disappeared. All of it disappeared. And maybe all the people like Michael Edwards and the people at Liverpool who were doing these jobs are geniuses that were being stifled by the way things were being done beforehand. Or maybe somebody of the intelligence, somebody with real intelligence and understanding of how to motivate people, understands what's important and what's not important, but also understands that he has got the authority and the final word, and that once he's getting what he wants, he doesn't care who contributes to him getting what he wants. And that's what Klopp has done at Liverpool. He's changed the entire conversation. I don't think it is, you know, people talk about Liverpool's recruitment and they talk about all these things, but ultimately it is meaningless without a manager who affects everything the way Klopp does. And you see that, and that's where you come back to United and something like someone like Mason Greenwood. I remember being at Stamford Bridge just after Klopp took over, and Jordan Ibe wanted Jordan Ibe to warm up. And he turned around, he told him to warm up, and he turned around And I was still, but 2 minutes later, I was still getting out of his tracksuit. And Klopp turned round and he went crazy. He just went crazy. And I'm like, you know, you should be ready. Mm. You should be ready now. And, you know, that was with one player. You had the situation with Sacco, who was kind of, you know, like joking around and filming and thinking, believing the hype that Klopp was some fun guy, you know, that he was just a joker and he could film. Remember that film in Alcatraz with Sacco and Klopp? And you could see, as Sacco was laughing away, you could see on Klopp's face, you're finished. Mm. You're done here. Everything he did was with an end point in mind.
Mm.
And that's what you need. Ferguson did the same thing at United. Wenger did the same thing at Arsenal when he came in. All of them knew exactly what they wanted and how they wanted to get it. And United don't have that. And that's the issue. And that's why all these issues will keep arising until you have somebody who gets that.
Yeah, very fair. I want to talk to you about Ireland then. They're at Wembley on Thursday. By the way, the Greenwood stuff, if you haven't seen it and you just heard me say interesting stories on Greenwood, I should have said the reports are that his application isn't so good, that Fernandez lost the plot with him in training when he didn't chase after a ball. They're concerned he's not getting enough sleep. And apparently one of the reasons he's not in the England squad is that Gareth Southgate called Solskjaer, which he does apparently with all the managers, just to check in, how's everyone going? And the word from Solskjaer was he might be better served at home and out of this squad for the time being. So that's where that story is. On Ireland, we're going to see what we could have had once again, as we do most weeks, in Jack Grealish and Declan Rice. So invariably this comes up with Stephen Kenny. It was interesting reading even the Sunday papers. There is definitely a sense, well, we should have got these two capped. You know, Martin O'Neill didn't try enough. Get Rice capped against Moldova. O'Neill shot that down as nonsense. Grealish, similarly, you know, we should have just accelerate them. And Stephen Kenny is talking about accelerating talent. If they're 16 and they're good enough to be in the 21s, get them into the 21s and so on. I have a level of discomfort with this. Would we feel better, if to put it in blunt terms, if we had hoodwinked in, locked Rice into a loveless marriage, locked Grealish into a loveless marriage, entrapped them for the next decade? They would have turned up, they would have played well, probably would have enjoyed it, you know? But is that fair? Is that what we want to do with young players, English players who've played underage for Ireland? And deep down at the back of our mind, we're thinking, they might switch. Should we not give them the space and say, you're free to switch? You know, don't commit to us until you're properly committed. Or should we just say, screw that, pragmatism rules, in you come, and you can regret it for the next 10 years afterwards?
Well, to answer your question, would we feel better? The answer is yes, we would. I'm not sure, you know, Jack Grealish or Declan Rice would feel better, but we would feel better. And that's all that matters.
So clearly you can't mean that.
No, I do, but I know, but I think I understand your point, but the thing that the issue with Rice and Grealish isn't that they should have been capped to trap them, but it's that they weren't, that their potential and ability wasn't recognized by the management at the time. They weren't going to be capped to trap them. They were going to be capped because at that point they should have been playing for Ireland.
I think O'Neill definitely tried to get Grealish, in fairness.
But eventually he did, but he didn't. He was slow. He was slow doing it. There was a time, if you remember that time around the time Aston Villa reached the beat Liverpool at Wembley in the Cup semi-final. And before that, O'Neill was giving it the old football man talk about, you know, you've got to, you know, earn your way up, and, you know, it's a big step up to international football and all this kind of stuff. And then Grealish went out and sort of demolished Liverpool. And it kind of changed the conversation about it. And he could have been capped before then. That was the point. Once Tim Sherwood came into Aston Villa, Sherwood really was aware of how he was going to, you know, what a talented player he was, how he could, you know, what he could do for England. Now, England only capped him 2 months ago.
Sure.
Which is a big mistake, which was, again, they took too long about it. Like, they really did take too long about it as well. So I know what you're saying. You don't want to be going around saying, right, let's get this player, let's get that player, because they qualify for more than one country and we could lose them. But I think I don't think that's what Stephen Kenny is talking about.
It's not what Kenny is talking about. He's talking about a more joined up thinking, and that's good. But I just detected, even I don't ask me to name pieces a couple of days on, but I detected a sense that we need to be sharper here. You know, we need to lock these guys in.
But we do need to be sharper in the terms of how we identify.
Okay, so from a football point of view, yes. What about an ethical point of view, though? We see a 19-year-old who's not mature enough yet to make this decision. We sense that when that same player hits 21, 22 and knows his own mind a bit better and is a bit more confident, he will switch. That's what he wants to do in his heart of hearts. Ethically, should we be locking that 19-year-old in? I don't think we should.
We get into this terrible then notion of what... like, how Irish do you feel? Like, all that stuff.
I think it's simpler than that, though. It's what does this player, ultimately, if we're looking ourselves in the mirror, what do we think this player will have wanted to happen? And we're putting our needs before that player's ultimate desires. Like, it's not even that complicated.
But you see, the problem with that is, it's like anything. Like, it's a question of choice. Like, it's very hard when you're in any situation. It's very easy to decide, like... This is the thing that's always missing in these conversations from people who do a bit of thumping and wrap the tricolor around themselves. Most of the time, they didn't have choices.
Yeah.
Be faithful when you don't have any choices. And it's harder. And as you say, especially if you're 19, 20, it's harder to do that if you feel you might have options or you might regret something. And this isn't to do with allegiance and whether you're English or Irish, but just that maybe this is what you want to do, or maybe that's what you want to do. So, but ultimately, I don't know what's going to change that much in a player or in maturity from the age of 19 to 21, 22. But I think what Ireland need to do, and what Stephen Kenny is going to be better at doing, is identifying talent. Rather than saying and identifying talent that can be effective at international level. Hmm. That's the thing. And that's the thing that was missing under O'Neill and, you know, McCarthy, although that's such a small period of time, it didn't really matter. But O'Neill really was hung up on this idea of kind of serving your apprenticeship, working your way through, you know, learning the ropes, doing this, and then taking the step up to international football. Nobody who watches international football seriously considers it's a step up.
Sure.
It's not.
No, on a football point of view, I can't disagree with that at all. I'm just talking more, do we want to play it cool, or do we want to put a ring on it before they have a chance to think about it? And that's, well, I think, you know, everyone will have a different view on that.
I get that. I understand that. But I think the flaw in that is, the flaw in these, in the when you're talking about Grealish and Rice, is that the failure wasn't one of, oh, we didn't snap them up and tie them down when we could have.
It was it was incompetence over benevolence on our part.
It was just we didn't understand
how good they were. It was absolute incompetence on our part. It was not like we looked at them and said, oh, we get the sense they're not sure, so we're not going to lock them in. It was not that. I'm actually asking, going forward, what kind of player on the stage do we want to be with 18, 19-year-olds? And what difference is there between an 18, 19-year-old who's technically allowed to vote and therefore can make up their own mind and a 21-year-old? I think there is some. Rice would have taken a call up at 19 and played that friendly against Turkey. 21, he was a bit more, you know, I'm not.
But it's circumstances. Right, but I don't know. Yeah, but that's also circumstance change. Now, maybe that's that does go to your point about what you want from what way you want to do it. But players will make decisions based on their circumstances and how they're feeling about situations at the time. So clearly, when they're younger and they have and they haven't evolved as much maybe in their club careers, they may be more willing to
settle.
Like, you know, settle for Ireland. But I don't see that as a big problem. I think it's something that we have to accept that. And like, you know, it would be great. Like, if everyone was saying, I love my country. There's nobody else I want to play for. Let me out there. I'm going to rip the legs off any, you know, like any traitor to the Irish flag. Like, but, you know, that's not the world. Like, that's not the world for lots of people. And I think you come back, and it's quite an interesting, you know, the fact that we're playing England, and obviously Rice and Grealish are part of the England setup. But, you know, that sense of identity, which this brought up, I think is a kind of an interesting one, because it does, I think you can be both. I think there are lots of people who've commented on this who always felt very Irish, and that's fine. But I think there is nothing, wrong with, you know, somebody like Grealish. Grealish can be as Irish as, you know, as any other first or second generation Irish person in England whilst playing for England.
Mm.
And it is a complex thing, that identity. And it's, and, you know, the Irish influence on in England is such a huge thing in all areas of life, that this is, maybe this is the satisfaction we have to take from this, that we are now, just as we did with, like, you know, with music, with so many areas, we are now just feeding English culture by giving them our, you know, our first and second generation footballers.
Yeah. No, it's true, and it's complicated. And I don't think Grealish or Rice played for Ireland underage in bad faith or out of cynicism. You know, I think they both had very genuine affiliation to the country, and still do, I suspect, even though that would prompt
angry
text to 53106 right now.
I imagine it's quite hard for them to feel much, but, you know, affiliation for, you know, considering what they've been through, and what are the, maybe been through makes it overly sympathetic to them,
okay.
But the, what they have, the
our reaction,
the reaction to the their decisions.
I thought we took it quite well. No, did I miss that?
No, maybe I must have been looking at. I must be in a different echo chamber on Twitter.
Right. Just a last point, then I'll let you go. Broad thoughts on Stephen Kenny. Needless to say, a win would be nice, and it would just pour a degree of coolant on the, you know, the brewing sense of, well, you know, maybe this football ain't for us after all. Where do you think he is, or what are you looking out for over the next three games beyond the obvious, which is a win?
Well, I think just progress again. And, like, I think it's a shame about McGoldrick's retirement, because he clearly brings something in the short term, and it's a loss. And obviously with the World Cup draw, you know, these results have a kind of degree of importance, which would be the only reason I'd be kind of thinking, you know, a win would be important. I think what Stephen Kenny is trying to do is far more important, and needs time, because I think it's ultimately it could have such great benefit for Ireland in changing how we actually, again it goes back to the point about the players, how we actually relate to the Ireland team, how we a sense of excitement and anticipation about watching Ireland, which let's be honest, has for the most part disappeared.
Yeah.
For lots of reasons, well beyond the power of just the management team, whoever they were. So, like, the FAI, every aspect of Irish football has lost any sort of sense of romance or hope. And I think what Kenny is trying to do is going to bring that back and change it. So I would be over time, I think he will do that. But I don't think it matters too much at this stage whether he gets a win or not. But obviously, if it just silences those voices who want to kind of carp about things, then it would be good to get some victories.
Dion Fanning, great to have you with us. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Joe.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, fueling the mischief in the beautiful game. Gamble responsibly. CWE.net.
Now, you're welcome back. So, not for the first time, and probably not for the last time, Finn Harps have done what looked very, very difficult, if not impossible. They have stayed up 8th place in the League of Ireland this season. They have avoided the relegation playoff and the relegation zone, and it is a huge sigh of relief, I suspect. It came down to the wire. We're joined by Ollie Horgan. Ollie, great to have you with us.
Hello, Joe.
I'd say the heart rate's just that bit slower today, that bit calmer.
Most certainly. Yeah, last night, you know, went right to the wire, and you know, anyone watching it in the 95th minute. Waterford hit the post, which would put us in the playoff and have turned the tables completely. So yeah, look, we had a bit of a rub of the green, Joe, and look, today at least we can enjoy it for whatever length of time.
Just to let people know listening about the general form, so before the season shut down, Finn Harps had 4 points on the board, one win and a draw. After lockdown, lost the first 6 games after returning, but finished the season then with 4 draws, 3 wins and 1 defeat to, as we've said, escape relegation. What sparks the turnaround, a turnaround like that?
Probably a little bit of rubber the green again. I mean, we came back in at the restart in August with 5 games, I think, in 12 days, and we couldn't draw a breath. We couldn't get a result through it, and the games came thick and fast, and we needed something to turn for us then, and it didn't. And it turned for us then, maybe further down the line, and once it turned, we were always going to improve. You know, how much or how far we're going to improve, mainly dependent on how the results went elsewhere, to put it that way to you. But look, luckily we got over the line last night. We always felt that we could get a playoff spot, which itself would be hugely difficult, as Longford will be on Saturday. But look, we got over the line. A little bit disappointed that we didn't get maybe a breathing space between the first number of games in August, because it was a horrendous restart. We hadn't kicked a ball since the middle of March, and we went into then playing competitive games, you know, in 5 and 12 days, I think is what it was. And, you know, I just thought that we couldn't play friendly games, basically. You know, we were just playing in-house games and trying to get ready for it. We picked up a number of injuries along the way, and is that the reason? Maybe we weren't just good enough at the time and confidence wasn't that high, but results breed that, and thankfully we turned it around.
So there was no great tactical change or superstar who emerged along the way. It was just gradually the tide turned kind of a story.
Yeah. Just we continue to work hard as we were in the month of August, and eventually it fell for us. No, it wasn't any tactical genius of me or Paul Higgerty, absolutely not. it was just continually trying to work hard, and to be fair to the players, it's tough for them physically and mentally, but they showed, you know, a huge amount of togetherness, especially when things weren't going that well, to stick at it, and they got their just results, you know, our rewards last night.
When you restart and you lose those first 6 games, what messages are you trying to give the players?
What messages? A lot of maybe bad words being thrown at them at times as well. Look, we've been there before, and we went, I remember years ago, I think we went 8 games without getting a result back in the Premier Division, when we also avoided relegation that year. We've been there before. Some of the players haven't, some of them have. And look, when you're down that end of the table, as we normally are, it's tough going. It's tough going for everyone. And, you know, we're hoping the experience that they went through, that finished last night, will stand to them wherever they go, if they stay or if they move on. But it's no bed of roses down there. You know, I don't know what it's like at the end of the table, but I would expect it. I know what it's like at the top of the first division. It certainly is an easier place to be when results are going your way. But we wouldn't swap it for the world, Paul or I, on the basis of being in the top division in whatever place.
What about the club generally? Because financially and every other which way, this has been a very difficult year.
Yeah, most certainly, only for the aid of you know, that we got to help us through to pay wages. As the same at every club, we wouldn't have seen the end of the season. The positives of the year would have been, you know, there was an injection into the board of energy that fundraised for a new changing room, which is absolutely brilliant on the far side of the pitch. So huge positives and strides that way. We need a new stadium for you know, training for to kick on. I see Emmett or Conor Hoy in Drogheda mentioning, you know, the need for a stadium that they've got promoted. You know, we've been there a number of years now, and look, we've fallen at the final hurdle with the stadium committee to try and get it over the line, and it's badly needed. You know, we're still in the Premier Division, whether we're welcome there or not, and you know, we'd love to see progress be made again. There was a lot of different attempts by our stadium committee, led up by Paul McLoone on the board. And unfortunately, you know, we're going again and we're hopeful again, but please God, this time it'll get over the line, Joe.
Because we've been talking about this stadium for a long time. I think the turning of the sod ceremony was about 12 years ago.
Yeah.
We, you know, this is what we're talking about here with this stadium. Very, very little, next to nothing has been done. I mean, I suspect that the broad answer here is just money and maybe some bureaucracy thrown in. What is the core issue? Why does this thing keep stumbling?
You're asking the wrong man, Joe, for the ins and outs of it. I mean, you know, of course you can go and blame money in these times, but, you know, there were better times where the money wasn't allocated, to put it that way, too. And, you know, politically or that type of way, I can't answer those questions. You know, that's a question for the stadium committee that have worked their backside off to restart this a number of times and to go again and go again. And they're doing that again for a number of times. But it's just it's a shame on the basis we are in the Premier Division for at least another 12 months, and it's just a shame that we don't have a facility to go with it. You know, the amount of work that was done by volunteers to get the pitch ready for last night, since the Shamrock Rovers game last Sunday week where there was torrential rain, you know, it was a credit to them. No, it's not a carpet by any means. We all know that. But there's only so much you can do when there's a amount of rainfall and the River Finn at the back of the pitch overflows. There's not a huge amount you can do, you know, if you're in that area and you don't have a new, if you like, turnkey place to go to, which was on the cards long before my time. And I just hope that it'll get over the line before our time is done.
So what, supporters came out to help try and, bring the pitch up to shape? Was there a big turnout or...?
Look, there was a lot of volunteers that came in that night after the Sunday night that we played Shamrock Rovers, and spent most of that night and several nights afterwards to get it into half-decent shape for the Waterford game yesterday. And, you know, they deserve a huge amount of credit. They didn't even get in to watch the game last night as a result of this, you know. And I think they deserve a lot of credit. And, you know, the fact that we didn't get relegated last night or this year when we didn't have supporters would have been a fair, you know, like we the worst thing that could have happened is that you went down in the year that's in it without any supporters, which in your home venue, and thankfully that didn't happen for us this year.
It's amazing they turned out and gave their time like that for a game they wouldn't see as well. And, you know, on GoFundMe you raised €30,000 as well. So there's a group up there, and we probably don't hear from them enough, for whom this football club is so important.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, we've had, you know, the likes of Ivan Hardy drove the GoFundMe page to basically install a fabulous changing room that allowed us, you know, segregate and allowed enough room in there to keep to the COVID guidelines. That itself, yeah, is a huge step in the right direction. We would love to be able to have a project where you're guaranteed in Stranraer that the new stadium would be resurrected and we'd be able to push on. But it's as I said to you earlier on, and I don't want to repeat it, it's fallen on deaf ears in different times, and it's crying out for, to put it that way, for you, not for my time or Paul's time, for generations after us. And with the underage structure we have there, which is very strong, we've competing that in finals in the underage levels, it's just a pity, you know, that we wouldn't have it there for them when they come through.
And are the FinHarps players all amateur or getting small amounts or semi or any full-time pros?
We have, yeah. We have a number of lads that have come in from overseas, you know, between Scotland, indirectly from Sweden. And we have a group of them that stay and stay together, obviously, in a house in Ballybofey. So we have a small group that are full-time and professional, but the majority of lads are part-time, and they also work as well, Joe, with, you know, on right. The basis to make up a shortfall in income.
Okay. Well, I mean, that's an extra struggle, isn't it? It's not like you could just impose a professional bubble in COVID times. You had fellas out working in the community and coming in.
Yeah, but to be fair, to you know, we kept the strict guidelines, both training and a match day and travel. And thankfully, we're one of the lucky clubs that it didn't affect, you know, and you know, that's, you know, had that happened, I don't know, would we have seen, you know, the result of staying in the division as what happened last night, you know. But look, it did, you know, with good protocol and also maybe a little bit of luck that went our way off the pitch, to put it that way.
Well, look, you need some luck in life, don't you, to do anything?
Yeah, most certainly.
So what does the off-season entail then, for instance, starting with the playing group? How many of them are, quote-unquote, contracted to stay on next season for a start?
Basically, very, very few. A lot of it depends on whether we stayed up or not, and that's only, in the last 20 hours that has been finalised. That'll take its course over the next number of days and weeks, to put it that way to you, Joe. It's very, very early days. We have a cup semi-final, or quarter final, excuse me, next Friday week against Shamrock Rovers that we'll prepare for. And we'll take things then to see where people stand and whether, people can stay or want to stay, or whether we can attract new blood in. But it's tough going the off season. It's probably worse than a hell of a lot worse than when you're playing. Mm. But it's the same for every club, and we're no different in trying to attract players, albeit with difficulty, but we have the carrot of still being in the Premier Division for them to play in.
Yeah, well look, it's a significant carrot. Congrats. I mean, if you a couple of weeks ago it wasn't looking so likely, but you've pulled that one out of the fire in a beautiful dramatic style, so that must feel good at least.
Yeah, look, we fully expected it to go to the wire as it did last night, or in the playoff come the weekend, and should the result had not gone away in Ballybofey last night, or the other results hadn't gone in our favour, we would fully be prepared to go and battle with Waterford, and that's what it would be, a battle with them, because, we prepared and watched, Paul and I watched Galway play them on Friday in Belfield, and should that have been the way of trying to stay up, then so be it. There was no guarantee we would stay up through last night, and there'd be no guarantee we'd have stayed up through Longford, but thankfully it happened last night and we got over the first hurdle of it.
Good stuff. Well, listen, thanks for the time, Ollie Horgan. Thanks a million.
You're welcome, Joe. Take care. Bye.
Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power, fueling the mischief in the beautiful game. Gamble responsibly. See dunlewy.net.